Welcome to the Security Perimeter,
an apocalyptic podcast,
starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulas. This is an awesome podcast, the best, guaranteed, 100%. We'll make Perimeter Podcast great again. My name is Lambro Christoulas, your announcer. And now, to my dad, Athanasios Christoulas, a.k.a. Saki.
Well, welcome back to the Security Perimeter Podcast. I know it's been a lot of time since I've put up an episode, but things are quite busy these days between my work, traveling, etc. So they'll be less frequent than I originally had planned, which was to put them up once a week. Today's guest is Colonel Jamie Cade, Deputy Commander Canadian Task Force in Afghanistan. In other words, he was the number two of the Canadian forces in Canada's contribution in Afghanistan. They were essentially in charge of like the meanest part of Afghanistan, if that means anything. The Canadians were in Kandahar, and I gotta say it again: Jamie was number two. Jamie's now retired. We discussed his experiences in Afghanistan, and I really got to tell you that it's incredibly interesting what Jamie is about to say, what you're about to hear, and it's also quite shocking in some respects. Definitely something I think everyone should listen to in order to better understand what happened or what is happening in Afghanistan right now. So before we get to the discussion, I just want to do some housekeeping things, kind of stuff. Well, first thing is I want to promote the webpage that's associated with this podcast. The webpage is thesecurityperimeter.com, and it's got a whole bunch of fun stuff on it, like it's got the podcasts, but it also has an entire section on fake news, and much of it is, of course, coming from Trump and also coming from Russia. I'm kind of hoping to get myself on, like, Putin's shit list. In fact, Putin, if you listen to this, if you put me on your shit list, then I promise I'll stop trolling you in the podcast and in the webpage. So please patronize the webpage. It's fun. It's interesting. There's lots of stuff there to see other than the podcast itself. All the episodes are there. What else is up for housekeeping? Oh, yeah. So the next episode we're going to do, to my chagrin to some extent, one of the most popular episodes was the one on Russian fake news and Putin, the Christmas special. It's the one that's gotten the most feedback of any of the podcasts. And the feedback was like, we want more of this. So my plan is for the next podcast to be sort of like the same thing. Maybe we'll call it the Easter special. And it will be on Trump this time. So other than those couple of items of housekeeping, and by the way, this is really kind of important, and it really doesn't take a lot of your time. If you're listening to a podcast and you like it, just click a like, or if you're on some kind of platform like iTunes or Stitcher and stuff like that, give me 5 stars. Don't give me 4 stars. Definitely don't give me 1 star. If you're going to give me any amount of stars, give it 5 stars. Doesn't really cost you anything, but it really helps the podcast. It helps spread the word about the podcast. The greater the number of extremely positive evaluations, the more likely, for example, platforms such as iTunes and Stitcher and so forth are likely to, bump you up in terms of their rankings and therefore give more people access to the podcast. So the goal here isn't to make me feel good or anything like that, although it will make me feel good. But the goal here is to help spread the word of the of the podcast. And if you've already given a 5-star review somewhere, well, then tell a friend about the podcast. If you've already given one of those 5-star reviews, then, you know, share the podcast to a friend. Tell them that, you know, this is like a totally cool, awesome podcast everyone in the world should be listening to. We take a little break in the middle of the discussion with Jamie. It's kind of funny, actually. It's an interview with a contestant for Miss Universe who believes that the problem with Americans and their inability to geographically locate their own country has to do with, well, I'm not going to tell you. You just really got to hear this. So enjoy, patronize, evaluate. If you can, it would be greatly appreciated. So now on to the interview with Jamie. Well, first of all, Jamie, thank you for agreeing to participate in the Security Perimeter podcast. And I think it would be awesome if the listeners get a chance to hear a little bit about your our Army career in general, you know, but mostly your experiences when you were in Afghanistan. So thank you so much, my friend, for agreeing to this.
No, Asaki, the pleasure is definitely all mine. This is a lot of fun, and I got lots I can share on experiences in Afghanistan. It was a fascinating time. Wasn't fun, but I certainly learned a lot, and a lot went on.
Okay, well, why don't we start like this? First of all, why don't we start with what was your I can't even think of the word. What was your job in Afghanistan?
Okay, so my involvement, I'll start by not answering your question. I was involved in two ways with Afghanistan. To begin with, I was, when we first moved our forces down from Kabul down to Kandahar province.
Now we're talking about Canadians, right? We're not talking about any other country here.
That's correct, yes. Right. I was, when we did the move down from our mission in Kabul, the Canadian forces into Kandahar, where we assumed responsibility for the province of Kandahar, I was the what we call the Army G3. So I was head of operations for the Army. Now, what you have to understand, and I was there for 2 years, which the 2 years where we first started to see combat operations on a serious scale, when we first started taking combat related deaths, we suddenly started to learn very, very fast. Now, to understand the way the Canadian Forces works is that the Army, Navy, and Air Force are what we call force generators. So they are responsible for training, equipping, selecting the right people, and putting the package together that has been asked for, in my case, of the Army. So I didn't plan all the training, but I made sure that they were getting the right people were putting together the right training for the right people at the right time, and the equipment was arriving.
So you were the guy who would say, okay, we need to do this, and in order to do this, we need to assets from here, assets from here, assets from here, and then you would sort of put it all together. Is that what you?
Yeah, I was the ringmaster of people, right, who organized the training, organized the movement of equipment. At the same time, I was responsible for ensuring that the Army carried on with supporting its schools, other units going on exercise, that they got what they needed. So I was the coordinator at the Army level, to ensure what was demanded of the Army was met to the Army's greatest ability. Okay. And obviously there was a Navy guy doing the same thing for the Navy.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
My involvement in Afghanistan was from May 2008 until February 2009, so 10 months.
Okay.
I was the deputy commander for all Canadian forces in the Afghanistan theater. Now, the Afghanistan theater included Kandahar, Kabul, Bagram, and El Minhad, which was a base inside a UAE base just outside of Dubai. That was our air base for support to the mission far as transport, moving materiel through.
And the Canadians had about the size of a brigade there, right?
Yes, yeah. At its peak, it was officially, I forget the exact figures, but it was about 3,200.
Wow.
Per rotation. In reality, it was actually closer to 3,600 because there was constantly surge teams going in, specialist teams to build something, to beef up intelligence or, you know, whatever the demand of the day was. So at its peak, we were rotating about 3,600 people offset through the course of 6 months for the fighting troops and for the headquarters, my group, it was just under a year.
Now, from what I understand, Canada had the second largest contingent in Afghanistan. Is that right? Or
no, that's not correct. Okay. Trying to remember the pecking order now. Certainly the U.S. was the largest. The Brits had a larger contingent than us. And I believe the Germans did as well up north. They were not in the south with us.
So I'm sorry. So the Germans, the Brits, the Americans, of course. But it was a significant...
That's the pecking order, not to confuse the issue. That's the pecking order as far as troop contribution. Mm-hmm. To the best of my memory, it's on Google. In our sector, we were in Regional Command South. That was a rotational command between the Brits, the Dutch, and ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the forces there were Canadian, British, Australians had a company, an engineer squadron embedded with the Dutch. There was also a Romanian battle group, and then there were American assets superimposed over everything.
And I guess it kind of worked the way NATO works, right? You had the Canadians there, and you had other countries' units attached to the area, but in the end, it was the Canadians who were the commanding officers, let's say. These units from, like, Holland that were attached, they wouldn't act independently of what, let's say, you would say, would they, or...?
From the Canadian task force, so they were called task force. So you had the British task force in Helmand Province, you had the Dutch task force to the north of us, the Canadian task force, and the Romanian task force. So they were Masomenos, more or less, brigade group size. Mm-hmm. All of us came under a divisional headquarters called Regional Command South.
Okay.
And the command staff for that headquarters were made up of officers and NCOs from all of the above mentioned countries.
Right.
But the command of that Regional Command South during my time, it would rotate every year between the Canadians, the Dutch, and the British.
What was cooperation like between the different countries?
It was very, very good. I mean, the positive side, I mean, the cooperation was good. We spoke with each other. There was regular coordination meetings over at the headquarters. The negative was that at the national level, each country had its own objectives, which wasn't completely
consistent with what was necessary on the ground, right?
Yeah. Yes. So, for example, the Brits, their big deal was anti-heroin, eradication of the poppies, of which the Americans were very strong on. Canada had a no eradication policy. We would not in any shape or form involve ourselves with eradicating poppies because the Canadian viewpoint was, yes, the heroin produced out of Afghanistan is a worldwide plague, but people who are growing heroin are not bad people. They are farmers trying to feed their people. And at the time of year where you would bulldoze the poppy crops, it's too late to plant wheat. So the Canadian viewpoint, national policy was, we've got nothing to replace it with if we bulldoze it over. So the farmer's got a choice. He can starve or he can go work for the Taliban.
Yeah, they'll die or become terrorists, basically. Yeah.
Yes.
I heard that Kandahar was one of the shittiest places to be in Afghanistan. Is that true, or is that just the National Post in Canada hyping up Canada's contribution?
No, it was a shitty place to be on a number of different levels. I couldn't agree more. Everywhere was tough in the south, but Kandahar in particular had the Panjshir district, and that's where the Taliban movement was born. Mullah Omar came from a village in Panjshir, and it didn't seem to matter what we did in that heartland. We just couldn't shake the influence of the Taliban out of that region. Very nasty countryside, a lot of grapevines, and you have to try and picture in your mind that to support the grapevines, they don't have wire fences like we do in Canada or they use in Europe. They built mud walls that the vines grew over. And these mud walls were very good at a couple of things. In the springtime when the leaves came out, superb camouflage for ambush. And secondly, small arms fire does not penetrate these walls, so they're almost like bunkers. And then you get drying huts where they used to turn the grape. They didn't make wine out of the grapes they grew. They made raisins, and those drying huts were much like tobacco kilns, but except they were like bunkers. It took some pretty heavy firepower to take somebody out that was holed up in one of these things.
Was there like combat operations on a daily basis, or were there some days that were more scary than others?
Seasonally, it was very much seasonal, except we found we were the first contingent where there wasn't a lull during the winter. The Taliban kept it up. What generally happened was during the winter, the Taliban leadership would move south to Pakistan, regroup, train, promote from within, try and unify. Because remember, one of the Taliban's great weaknesses was it's a tribal-based society. So, your friend today may be your enemy tomorrow. So you're always working on alliances and trying to keep the cohesion. We did not have that problem. In the summertime, they would come in, and that's when they would in the spring, they would come up, and that's when you would really see things flash up. And when all the foliage was out, combat was almost on a daily basis because we would patrol on a regular basis. We would launch our own operations, of course, both regular force and more focused operations on the special forces side.
And these operations are designed to knock out threats in the area, surrounding areas?
Yeah. I mean, we used to have the saying, kill one Taliban foot soldier and you've created 10 more because there's now a blood debt within the family.
Yeah.
What we tried to do was take out the leadership. Those were the folks that we were interested in. Also the technical experts, the guys that were making the IEDs, improvised explosive devices, not the guys that actually planted them, because, the farmer whose crop failed could be doing that.
And he's probably being forced to do that.
Precisely. We tended to go with focused operations. Or if we got intelligence that there was large concentrations, because usually, generally speaking, a large concentration of the Taliban building up meant they were preparing for something.
Right.
So preemption was a top priority for us.
Now, when you say you use the word take them out, do you literally mean take them out or do you mean something
else? Yes.
We can edit out this answer if.
Oh yeah, no, this is fine. No state secret here. I mean, when special forces operate, generally a mission is brief, kill or capture. And depending on the situation, there could be a lot of advantages to capturing somebody, or you're out to kill them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was war. Although Canada never declared war, the government was loath to describe it as war. Saki, right. It was war. And they were killing us, and so we were trying to kill the right people on their side to weaken them. But remember, all of this was about the buying time. We never believed that we would militarily ever defeat the Taliban. What we believed is that we could weaken the Taliban to such a point where the Afghanistan government could assume responsibility for doing what government should do, which was provide security for its people, feed its people, electricity, sanitation, that sort of thing. So while all these combat operations were going on, there was a lot of Canadians from good people from all countries trying to build up the economy, tutoring government officials, bureaucrats, that sort of thing.
A lot of news reports, a lot of rumors about the behavior of troops in Afghanistan and violation of human rights and so forth. How would you respond to that comment?
So large barrel, occasionally there's bad apples. What I can say on the Canadian side is that we had very few of them. Our soldiers are... I joined the Army back in 1979. I went to military college. And back then, the movies at the box office were Taps and the Lords of Discipline. Now, I don't know if you remember those movies. And so about private military schools gone bad. And everyone had this mental image back then that soldiers were, you know, baby killers, undisciplined. You're in the Army because you couldn't get a real job. Well, that is not the reality, especially today. Our soldiers are extremely well educated and they care. Ethics. We are constantly running tutoring sessions, discussions, that sort of thing. Plus, we had very, very strict rules of engagement.
That's what I wanted to ask. Can you give an example of the rules of engagement that were being employed by Canadian troops on the ground?
Okay, well, depending on your mission, so each soldier has a soldier card. No matter what mission you're on, whether you're in Bosnia, when I was in Bosnia back in the 90s, I had a soldier's card. Everybody had a soldier's card. Soldier's card tells you what your rules of engagement are. So you've got them memorized, but just in case you don't. They also have the law of unarmed conflict, the law of armed conflict. Written out on it. And then, a couple other things to remember, like international law and Canadian law applies to every Canadian citizen, no matter where you are in the world. Mm-hmm. So what's a crime in Canada, if you commit it in Afghanistan, it's still a crime.
It happened in Somalia, right?
Exactly. Well, Somalia was one of the reasons that we really got disciplined about this whole thing, because Somalia was not just a national shame, it was a shame to the Canadian Army specifically, and we went through a massive cultural shift, and I lived it. I wasn't in Somalia, but I lived the cultural shift.
It was big news, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was hard years thereafter, because the Canadian public lost faith in us.
Yeah.
So Afghanistan, our biggest fear was that this would, you know, that we would see this sort of thing again in Afghanistan, because it was a tough environment for any soldier to be operating. But completely different army, disciplined army. Our soldiers understand that it's a slippery slope. So if you start making, you know, oh, well, he was a bad guy, it's really easy to rationalize everything you do after that point. And once you've lost the moral high ground, where are you? particularly when you're fighting somebody like the Taliban. We had our problems. Captain Semerau, who was court-martialed for executing a wounded Taliban, but he was convicted of disgraceful conduct after reading on the internet. But it was on my tour that this occurred. It was reported. It was investigated. There were a lot of pundits out there in the media who wanted to make this another Somalia. And funny enough, it was the media themselves who came out and said, no, this isn't Somalia. The armed forces has reported it. They've reported it officially and in the media. They're not saying anything on it because it's under investigation. It's a police investigation. And, you know, justice will see its due course. So in the end, we did demonstrate that we had learned a lot from Somalia. There was no cover up.
Did you have army lawyers who would, you know, give the go no go kind of evaluation based on international law or other criteria with respect to some kind of operation, special forces operation or something like that?
Yes, that's an excellent question, Saki. Yes, always. So there were, as we said, we had our rules of engagement, and there were, depending on what you wanted to do, some things because of the element of the level of risk of collateral damage or the level of risk in another area. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, the authority for the action was held back at a higher level. So at the brigade commander's level and my level, because the brigade commander, General Thompson, was always forward where he belonged. So quite often it came down to me. So when the decision brief was made on whether or not to authorize, say, a strike, a Predator missile strike on a high-value target, there was always the lawyer. Any mission brief, the lawyer was always there. The senior intelligence officer was there, and the chief of operations were always there. And Dennis and I always turned to all three of them before we made our decision, saying, are you satisfied? Do you have any questions?
Who's Dennis?
Dennis Thompson. He was the commander. He was my commander. Right. I was his deputy.
Okay.
So you know, it would be, you know, head of intelligence, are you satisfied that the intelligence is reliable? Do you have concerns about it? Is there anything you need to add? Lawyer, is this legal? Mm-hmm. If it's not legal, is there a legal way of doing what we want to achieve here? So everything had a very strict process to make sure that the right decisions were decision making is different, but the decisions that were made were legal and the best decision to make based on the information we had available.
Jamie, this is not only about Canada's involvement, but I'm talking about the entire coalition. What are the numbers? How many people were killed in this thing, in as far as the Afghanis are concerned?
In our operations, some operations we killed a lot of Taliban. Occasionally, there were innocents killed. Accidents occurred. We killed two children. This was a convoy going down the road, and uncle was driving the two kids in a white vehicle. A suicide bomber attack, it seemed, was in a white vehicle. The vehicle pulled aside to the side of the road to let the convoy move past, which is exactly what it should have done. Mm-hmm. And then, for whatever reason we don't know, he did exactly what he should have never have done. And as the convoy was halfway across, he pulled back out onto the road, which is a classic suicide attack. The gunner or the crew commander that saw that vehicle move had a split second to make a decision, and unfortunately he made the wrong decision. The uncle was just stupid, and unfortunately
how's his gunner, you know, in the head?
Don't know, but after those sorts of incidents, there's always peer counseling, and then the Padre usually comes around. There's almost always follow up after these sorts of incidents.
Jimmy, what
and
about
every soldier? Actually, you reminded me of a point. Every soldier is trained in peer counseling that we send overseas. And what peer counseling is how to recognize the signs of your buddies or others that may be starting to succumb to battle stress, PTSD, and also how to ask the right questions or talk it through, and how to recognize it in yourself and how to talk it through yourself with others.
It's a tough question, but how do you feel about the kids?
It was, oh shit. It was, this is terrible. Feel terrible. Yeah. But was I emotionally connected? No, not at all. Okay. Not at all. It's just too far removed from it. And I mean, understand that the Taliban, I'm not saying this to belittle the accidental incident, mm-hmm. but I mean, the Taliban use children as human bombs against us. There was an incident in the Panjwani where a grandfather or an old man sent a kid over to the patrol, two Canadian sergeants wounded and two Afghan soldiers killed when the kid was detonated. The old man had wrapped a bomb.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. You said when the kid was detonated. I've never heard that before.
We were encouraging kids to go to school, especially girls. And in Kandahar City, the Taliban started a terror campaign.
Against the women, yeah.
Yeah, and one little girl had acid splashed in her face. They came by on a motorcycle and threw acid. She was on her way to school in her little school outfit, and she had acid thrown in her face. You know, this sort of stuff was going on constantly.
You know, my view on this, and I know you're not gonna comment on this, but these men, it's because it's the men mostly, right? They're animals. They just have no, they lack human decency, and unfortunately when the world press is looking at what's going on in Afghanistan, they just don't get the fact that there's something wrong with these guys. I mean, they're not well. You don't have to comment.
They're very good people there.
I'm talking about the Taliban. I'm talking about
I'm with you. You're right. There are some very, very sick people out there. I mean, that country has been ravaged by war for 40 plus years, I think it is.
Goes back to the beginning of the 19th century with the British.
I don't think I've studied a lot of Afghan history, and there's very few periods in their history where they had a peace of any length of time.
It's an,
Our general opinion was the entire nation was suffering from PTSD. The entire nation.
Okay. Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our
children. Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Hello, this is David Wilkinson, UCLA political science professor, and you are listening to the Security Perimeter Podcast, the gold standard of perimeter podcasts.
I forgot my question. I'll remember it in a second, and then I'll edit out this brain fart here that I'm having. Back in 2000, when Chrétien, the Prime Minister of Canada at that time, announces that Canada is going to participate in the war, there was a lot of debate in the country about it. There was a lot of debate as to, you know, why are we doing this? But there was also a lot of debate as to whether or not we were prepared for it. What do you think about that?
Matter of fact, is I was a lieutenant colonel back then, and I was actually involved on our joint staff, who is the force employer. They actually are command the troops that are deployed around the world. And it was my team that put together the brief that was given to Minister Eggleton to make the decision on whether three PPCLI battle groups should go or not.
Yeah.
We believed it would be combat operations. In the end, they didn't actually see that much action, thankfully. That came much later. But the Army was in the process of modernizing, but thanks to peacekeeping operations like Bosnia and others, we were starting to get more modern equipment, but it was a slow process. I mean, Canada was still recovering from the big recession of the 80s, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So through the 90s, it's, you know, you're not going to get a lot of money fast. So when 3PPCLI went over, we had no experience in desert warfare, and we had nothing for desert warfare. We couldn't even get camouflage.
I was about to mention there was a big debate about even the uniforms that the Canadians were going to be using over there.
Yeah, I can tell you, we scoured the planet trying to buy desert camouflage uniforms for 3PPCLI. But at the time, everybody was getting ready to go to war in Afghanistan. You know, the US, the UK, some other notable allies of ours, everyone was gearing up and scrambling. So yeah, they didn't go in with the best of equipment, but we were buying equipment just as fast as we could get it. We were also borrowing stuff. Americans were very good allies to us. They helped us out an awful lot. And we continued as we learned more. That was the other thing, is that you don't know what you don't know. So as we really started to get into the fighting in Kandahar, and this was a couple of years later when we're now up, we've got a brigade group there now. We're now in combat operations on a regular basis in Kandahar. Mm-hmm. You see, we got 155 millimeter mortar, artillery, the M777. That is one of the finest artillery pieces in the world.
That's a dangerous piece of equipment, yeah.
Incredibly precise. We got the Leopard 2 tank. We now have the LAV 6, but also just soldier systems, protective equipment for the soldier, communications equipment. So yeah, we started out. Night vision.
The night vision stuff as well.
We used to talk about owning the night back then, but now we own the night. We operate just as well at night as we do during the daytime.
Yeah, because I heard they didn't have the night vision in the beginning of the stuff, right?
Well, they had it. Was very rudimentary. It was not top tier. It was older technology, but it was purchased as fast as we could. Did 3PPCLI get all of this stuff during their tour? No, absolutely not. Some of the stuff. I mean, just to get it through Treasury Board's a struggle with anything. Now, Treasury Board cooperated. We bought a lot of equipment that was fast-tracked because there was a war on.
You know, what's your evaluation? Was it a good decision? Did we do the right thing to go there?
Yeah, absolutely. Did we win? I don't know. They're still fighting. And that insurgency, because it is an insurgency, it's not two sides lined up against each other. Mm. That'll go on for a long, long time. Was it good for the Canadian Army? Absolutely it was. Because it allowed us, first of all, it forced us to get our, to really, modernize ourselves, get serious about our training. So we now have the Canadian Maneuver Training Center, completely digitized sensor training area where if it's the most elaborate laser tag game you'll ever go into, and it's all recorded. So
can I go?
You know what? That might be possible to arrange. But we modernized, but we also we did things like we actually embedded lesson learned people with the forces over in theater, so that if the Taliban changed their tactics, these guys did the scientific analysis of it and the training and needs analysis, and the change in modus operandi was immediately sent back to the guys training to replace the guys that were currently in theater. We never had that sort of system before, so we learned lessons much, much faster. And pride, incredible pride. Now, was it good for the country? Big debate, because it was never – it was barely popular in – or I wouldn't say popular. It was never popular. It had – just a margin of majority for approval ratings in English Canada. And
can I just say that I supported it, so, you know, for the record.
Yeah, right on. I fully understand why people didn't support it at the time. In Quebec, in French Canada, the majority of the population were dead against it.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
But yeah. People didn't really understand what the mission was about. But that aside,
and that's Christian's fault, isn't it? Right,
Harper as well. They did a horrible job of explaining what this was about. Foreign Affairs worked really hard at trying to explain the story, but everyone, the media, was always focused on combat operations. But Canada as a whole, and this is Jamie Cade speaking, Canada as a whole grew up. Because before it was always, well, we need to be doing the Blue Beret thing. We need to do the – and Canadians still to this day have this mental image of Blue Beret UN operations being, you know, nice and squishy, and we're just nice guys doing nice things. Yeah, so Canadians finally started to realize that it's a rough, tough world out there, and – we went into Afghanistan for the right reasons. It was to root out Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda, and when we went in, there were biological labs in Kandahar. They were working on some nasty stuff. And so Al-Qaeda was kicked out of Afghanistan. We're then faced with the Taliban. The Taliban regime was taken out of power. Then we felt a moral obligation to rebuild the country, one, so that the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban wouldn't come back to power. Mm-hmm. But also, certainly on the Canadian side, we felt a moral obligation in that this country had been bombed to the Stone Age, so let's try and help the country get back on its feet. Canadians were faced with this problem. Canadians were faced with Canadians being killed overseas. I remember at the time when I was the Army G3, you know, people with office talk was Canadians will take 2, 3, 4 casualties and that's it. Then we're done. We'll pull out.
Well, how many died?
In the end, I just got to go. I wrote it down here. Sorry, bear with me. I'll find the number. So 159 Canadians were killed in total.
Now my understanding, percentage-wise, that's the highest losses from the coalition forces. Is that right?
It was certainly way up there. It was, I don't recall. Unfortunately, I could have told you, I could have given you the answer about 4 years ago, but okay. I'm old man now. But it was 159 killed, soldiers killed. 123 of those were hostile action. Mm-hmm. In total, we had 2,047 injured. Everyone focused on...
For a country the size of Canada, that's incredible.
Yeah, and a regular force, Canadian Armed Forces, of about 65,000 people.
Oh.
We were in it. We were absolutely committed to it. And Canadians took a pride in this, I think. And maybe mm-hmm. it's coincidental, but when the Highway of Heroes, the portion of the Highway 401 from Trenton to Toronto, where the dead would be, their remains would be moved down to the coroner's office in Toronto for the autopsy. Mm-hmm. all of that. Shortly thereafter, Canadians started waving flags a lot.
Yeah, I remember that. You remember the bridge scenes where, right.
But also at home. And nowadays, Canadians are much more prone to wave flags and put them up and go yahoo and be loud and boisterous about being Canadian. Also, we got really into our Olympics now. But before it was a bit resolved. My impression now, it's we're go take Canada go. We're not ashamed to you know go rah rah for our country like every other country in the world does.
And we used to be, yeah.
Yeah,
you're right. In the 70s and the 80s, it was like
subdued. It was well, that's tacky. No, we're not like that.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah.
So. Maybe it's a coincidence, but I think Afghanistan created an awakening amongst the Canadian people.
You kind of answered the question that I was going to ask you. There's only a couple more, so don't worry. Do you think we did the right thing from like an ethical, moral standpoint? And you said yes.
Yes, I do.
You answered yes. And you're fully convinced of that.
Yeah, I am. I think we had to do what we did. Here's the problem, though. We didn't get there. Not in our time. And there's a number of reasons for that. And this is my viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is you can't help people that don't want to be helped. And wanting our money is not the same as wanting to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is we go in with our ideals and we're handcuffed to democracy. It would be unfathomable that we would go into a country and promote a dictatorship, let's say, a benevolent dictatorship. We have to promote democracy. Kandahar province alone, 80% illiteracy rate. 80% of the people in Kandahar cannot read. And that was pretty much standard for all of Afghanistan, except for maybe the capital, Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
How does a democracy survive if people can't read, so they rely upon word of mouth for everything? The wandering mullahs from the Taliban, they used to go around the countryside and they would say, the Quran says it's okay to kill the infidel. It's okay to kill if it's the infidel.
Yeah.
It's okay to kill other Afghans if they work for the infidel.
Yeah.
The Quran does not say that. But how does somebody who doesn't read verify that the Quran doesn't say that? So we're promoting democratic values and democracy, and the corruption ran circles around us. Karzai was a man with a difficult job. He was part of the problem. I mean, his half-brother ran Kandahar province, and he ran things from behind the scenes, and he was involved in pretty much everything illicit going on. He undermined us, in my view, every chance he got, if it wasn't in his interest. But that is in a lot of ways, that's the Afghan way. It's very tribal. It's about looking after your own, looking after your family.
Yeah.
And it's about making sure you're on the winning side, because if you're on the losing side, it's going to end up very poorly for you. So my analogy for the Taliban, or sorry, not the Taliban, the Afghans in general, and the majority of them are good people.
Mm-hmm.
They're like the coyote. I don't know if you've spent much time out in the Canadian prairie, but mm-hmm. If you ever watch a coyote going across the prairie, he always stops every once in a while and sniffs the wind, because mm-hmm. the wind tells him so much, and which way the wind is blowing is so very important.
Mm-hmm.
Afghans will change sides in a heartbeat
mm-hmm.
once they see the wind, and if they see the wind is going not your way, mm-hmm. then they shift and start helping the other side, but they won't tell you they've done that, and vice versa.
It sounds as though you're saying that democracy really would never have worked there.
Democracy won't work there is my
not
first
not point. Not then, not now, not in the future.
Not until you have education. I mean, okay, Kabul is a fairly modern city. Kandahar is not. Kandahar city is not. Kandahar countryside. It's like you've gone into the Stone Age. People live in mud huts, with great big walls built around them to protect them. cells. It is a very, very violent society. It is a very difficult place to live. They don't care about democracy. The other thing we pushed, and boy, a lot of people would probably want to hang me for this, but you know, I got to speak my mind. Quite rightly, Canada, one of our national policies is no matter where we get involved in the world, we promote women's rights, education of women, protection of women. I agree with that 100%. But you can't do it all at once, particularly in a country like Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, we were very big on the women's rights issues. That was working up in Kabul, and that's we're pushing it there was fine, or not pushing it, working with it, because it is such an important thing. The problem was down in the countryside in Kabul, when you start preaching women's rights and there's no women in sight because they're cloistered in their homes. You're not going to convince the local population that you're not there to subvert them and suppress their religion and such. We were dealing with some very, very ignorant people, and we were trying to promote some very, very complex aspects of society that I'm not saying we shouldn't do that in Afghanistan. I'm saying that's a long time coming before they're ready for it. I mean, we just really, there's a national policy that doesn't link up with reality on the ground. We also tried our best, and this was the whole of government approach. We tried our best to do projects that would encourage economic development, to train bureaucrats, policemen, such. Anyone, anywhere where we got footage as far as training people and they actually started to reform and start to do what needed to be done, they were assassinated. It was as simple as that.
No shit.
Yeah. Or they were moved. They were moved somewhere else. The government, the central government said, and moved them along. On the economic side, most of the area was too dangerous to go unless you went there loaded for bear. So that was the army had to escort you in. And, you know, we couldn't be doing nothing but inspecting economic projects, economic development projects. So the corruption there, I mean, the ripoff was, I don't know for a fact, but pretty damn sure that a lot of stuff didn't get done. And it wasn't for lack of trying from CEDA or Foreign Affairs. They tried their damnedest. We worked every which way on these things. But the reality is, until you've got the security, it is really, really hard to promote economic development if you don't have security. And, you know, it was a vicious circle that we could not break.
Can I ask you one last question?
Yeah, sure.
You may not want to answer it, but what was your shittiest moment there?
Oh boy, I had a lot. Shittiest moment. Oh, that's a tough one. Because we did deal with a lot of bad things.
You told me one time where there were some guys out there and there was not much you can do to help.
This was an outpost. The structure we had at the time was that there was a series of small and smallish outposts, and we ended up collapsing them because they were untenable. This was a section, so it was about, at the time, it was about 15 men. It was a bad sandstorm, and the Taliban attacked this outpost. They got a lucky shot, and they destroyed the machine gun, killing one of our soldiers and wounding another. At the time, it appeared that he was seriously wounded. We could not do two things. We could not get in air support or any relief into them because of the sandstorm. You have to understand, sandstorms there are like the movie The Mummy, where you've got this wall of sand. That's the reality. It is exactly like that, except you don't get the image of the mummy's face coming on the sand. We could not get in medevac helicopters to evacuate the wounded soldier, and we were frantically calling around finding anyone, anything that could be bring relief, because we thought this section was going to be wiped out.
What happened in the end?
in the end, the Americans had a B-1 bomber up, and apparently they have a radar that looks right through sand. And they very graciously put a bomb down, and that was the end of our problem.
But B-1s are high-altitude strategic bombers, aren't they?
Yeah, strategic bombers, yeah. It was a special case. And first and only time I actually saw that occur in Afghanistan. The worst, the one where I felt the shittiest, captain, he's out on night patrol. It was just one of those things. They're out on night patrol, and there's wells all through the area. It's a desert country, so, and this well was overgrown. They didn't see it in the dark, and he fell in. He's in the water, and he's down. He's down a long ways. He's fine. He's okay, but he's got all his combat gear on, and he can't get it off.
So the weight.
The weight is dragging him down, and the patrol didn't have rope with him because there was no reason to have rope with you. This was the last thing we thought. So in the command post for this, the calls, the reports coming in, and it's just, it was a shitty thing.
So this is just was that low point for you?
Yeah. It was certainly one that comes to
mind. One of the low points, but.
Yeah, there was a number of incidents that we had to deal with that, they were sad.
Well, I'm sorry for asking you about that. It's just that I thought the listeners would want to hear a story like that to sort of get a feel about how what it's like being there, but from the perspective of the good guys, right? The guys who are trying to make a difference, and so I'm sorry I brought it up, but.
No, nothing to apologize for. It doesn't offend me. It doesn't bother me. I mean, it's part of the experience. I won't say there were any great moments. I mean, we had victories. There were things that made us very happy. But I'll tell you, I did not enjoy my time out, my 10 months there, but I would never trade it in. If I could redo everything, I would definitely still go to Afghanistan and be the deputy commander, because the people, the Canadians that I work with and the other nationalities in the coalition that I work with, just incredibly tough, smart, analytical people, very, very hardworking. They care. And what a sense of humor. Black humor. When you have bad incidents, black humor can get you through the day. Not at the moment, but you laugh. I'm rambling a bit, but
no, go ahead.
We introduced the ramp ceremony. No other nations were doing that, and that was a very simple ceremony when we were sending one of our fallen home, or a number of our fallen, unfortunately, was the case sometimes. My responsibility was the parade commander whenever was a Canadian, and so everyone, we would do it at night for security, because you're standing target out on the runway, and the casket with the Canadian flag would the entire task force, all nations that were in Kandahar airfield, would line up and salute, and there was a prayer, and they would put the casket on the aircraft, and the last word of command for that ceremony was Task Force Kandahar, carry on. And the words, it was not me that designed the ceremony, but whoever did it really got it right, because
it's nice. Sounds nice.
We've said goodbye to our fallen comrades, and now it's time to get on with the show. You can't dwell on it. You got to move on.
Well, Jamie, you kind of got me depressed right now. So, well, Jamie, thank you so much for this. I don't want to take up any more of your time. Thank you so much. And you know what? They say this all the time, but I really mean it from my heart right now. And I hope you can see it from the video. Jamie, thank you for your service. I appreciate it. We all appreciate it. I think you did a good thing. I think you were trying to do a good thing. I just wish more people in the world realized the good things that we were trying to do in Afghanistan, not the Canadians only, but, you know, like you said, the British and the Germans and so forth. And unfortunately, perceptions are not, the perception is not the case. And it's sad. And people, and a lot of, you know, young guys died, in a war where they're not really appreciated. And I find that very, very upsetting. I'm glad you said that about Canada. And now that, you know, the whole pride thing and the Highway of Heroes and how it changed, right? As the number of killed increased. But my sense is globally that, people don't understand what we were trying to do, what you were trying to do there. They keep on doing, oh, it was because of the oil
Afghanistan's got no oil.
It's got no oil, or it was because of the you know what I mean, right?
I heard it all, yeah.
And it's upsetting for me to hear that, and it's upsetting for me to hear that from students. When we have discussions about these kinds of things, and you know, I kind of know what happened. I know more now with our discussion, and it's going to help me a lot with my teaching. People need to know this, Jamie, and not enough do. So I appreciate it. And hey, I'll see you next week. Okay.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And thank you for inviting me to do this. It's been excellent. I'm glad you liked it. And again, thanks for everything you're doing for us down south.
Hey,
we'll see you next week.
Yeah, I mean, you're retired now. You're a colonel, retired colonel, at a young age, and you get your pension. And I hate you for that, because I still got 10 years. So what are you doing? what are you doing now? I mean, other than gardening.
I'm the wife's got plans for a bathroom to be remodeled, but my big work right now is consulting. I do a little bit of military training with a company called Callion. Usually internationally. I was down in Bogota just a couple of months ago helping with a course down there. My big work right now is PAL Aerospace and CartNav, and it's about doing what we've been doing is coaching them on cultural considerations, trying to get doors open for them. We're PAL and CartNav are in the long game.
But what does PAL Aerospace do?
It's maintenance, repair, and overhaul of aircraft. So MRO, if you want to use the industry jargon. They specialize in airborne surveillance. They operate their own aircraft. They modernize other people's aircraft. They'll rent you aircraft. They will crew the aircraft for you, and you own all the information if you're renting it or leasing it. Mm-hmm. If you will take your aircraft and modernize it, if you need an aircraft, we'll find you a secondhand aircraft and modernize it for you, and we'll train you on how to use it, how to maintain it. CartNav Solutions, they write software that gets various systems to talk to each other. So if you've got a certain type of camera and you can't connect it to your command and control center,
right,
CartNav Solutions will write the software that'll do it.
And it's software that's specifically written for that buyer.
It'll be a system they've already got that they'll
tailor it to.
Or they'll write it new if they need to. Funny enough, their system, they own AIMS, which is a software system that you find in so many different systems around the world, because the big guys have all bought this software, and it's in a lot of their stuff. So countries will have a CartNav product that they don't even realize they've got it until they talk to CartNav.
Are you enjoying yourself with this? Is this fun?
I love it. It is so different. Well, I laugh. So I'm a cavalry officer. I'm tanks, right? My background.
Right.
An armored reconnaissance. So you got a cavalry officer flogging aerospace. I mean, okay. Pigs can fly, Zach.
The bus drivers.
But Duert, who you met, yeah. Duert and I worked together. Well, actually, way back when, Duert, Larry, and I were all at Royal Roads Military College 1,000 years ago. Duert approached me saying, "Would you like to come in on contract on an as needed basis to help us?" It started out pursuing a contract with the Mexican Air Force, and Pell Aerospace's assessment is, you know, they can do more in Mexico, and so they really want to build up their presence and put a permanent presence down there.
So you're keeping yourself busy.
Yeah, I am.
Well, that's good.
And I do a lot of your stuff too.
What's that?
I do a lot of volunteer stuff too. So. That fills the other days.
Like what? Like what do you volunteer?
Well, my regiment's got their fangs deep into my neck, so we have a regimental society that raises money, not for profit, to run things like our mounted troop. This is actually a period piece of the Lord Strathcona's Horse. There's 22 soldiers that are in brass helmets and red serge, and they do a musical ride. That's all privately funded. I also am on the board of directors for the Canadian Corps of Commissionaires for the Kingston and Region area. Corps of Commissionaires is a not-for-profit company. Board of directors is a volunteer position.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
Yeah, well, thank you, and we'll see you next week, buddy.
Say hi to Dewey.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
I will. Okay, buddy.
Colonel.
Cheers.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, right on.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.